RadioInfluence.com.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Dark to Light podcast with
Franklin. I feel like you caught me with my pants down.
Well, that's good. You're in preparation for your show later.
I guess so.
With Franklin.
With Frank, me.
So just a little word to everybody. Today is Friday, August 31st, 2018. And we had a little bit of an audio issue. So things might not be as crisp and as clean because we had to kind of go to plan B. But hopefully this works out for everybody and we're good and, you know,
it all. You didn't say beans, by the way.
Oh, I'm beans. Hi.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a way to start the show.
I know. But hey, things happen.
Ain't that
but a lot of things are happening. I don't even know if I'm prepared for most of the stuff that you're going to bring up today because so much is happening in such a little time.
Yeah, it's a very busy week. Every week so far, you know, for the past like 3 or 4 weeks, it's been busy.
Been liking it because it was slow before then.
But there's a lot of really cool stuff going on like that. You know, some of the let me just put a disclaimer out there today, you know, right off the bat, is that some of this stuff that we're going to talk about today is going to be just like my mind vomiting. And it's going to be more like speculation, theorizing. And when it is not that and it's factual, like straight book factual, I will tell you. Otherwise, welcome into the mind of Tracy Beans for, you know, an hour today.
Because I can't wait.
A lot of shenanigans. And, you know, I'm just... You know, the fudge rule. We've talked about it a million times. I'm soaking all of this in and all of it's interwoven and all of it means something. And I just don't know what at this point. You ever feel like unsatisfied about something?
Yes. Yeah, quite often. Yes.
Like where you're just not settled on it and you're like, it's unfinished. Like it's not complete, you know?
Yep.
That's what I feel like.
I usually every day when I'm writing my show for the evening, I feel unsatisfied and incomplete probably around the 3:30 p.m. area. Then I have to walk away for an hour. I come back and I start making slashes and cuts. Sometimes you just got to sleep on things, you know, a good night's sleep or anything that's the equivalent of that. Walking away, changing up the scenery. You got to get away from things sometimes. Then you come back with a fresh pair of eyes and it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so, you know, sometimes people will like DM me or ask me like, what do you think about this? And I'm like, like bats and, you know, whatever fly out. Cobwebs.
That's it. Cobweb filled bats.
Yeah. Like a bad episode of like some really old 80s cartoon about Halloween.
Oh, I can't wait. Listen, that's the one thing I can tell you without fail. That I am so excited for, and I know 100% what I want to happen. And that is Halloween and crisp October northeastern weather. I cannot wait for the spookiness of October.
Well, that's good because there's supposedly, if you've been watching Brendan Straka from Walk Away, there's supposedly where we're being told to save the date at the end of October, the last weekend in October, save the date.
Okay.
So everybody out there, save the date. I don't know why yet. We'll find out today. I think he's announcing it today, but it's been all week he's been talking about this amazing thing, whatever it will be.
World's a mysterious place, and Brandon is just one more layer of that mystery.
Wouldn't it be cool if, like, it was something Halloween related and we could all get together and, like, dress up as, like, horrible political figures together?
Oh, that'd be great. Need some cheap suits.
Yes.
Some cheap suits and some fake blood. That'd be great.
We could just go to the Clintons. We wouldn't need any fake blood. Dun dun.
But
okay. Allegedly.
Allegedly, we all be dead.
Allegedly. Okay, so let's start the show. Let's start. We're going to start today with Trump's legal team, Giuliani, speaking out saying that they're putting together a quote counter report to question Robert Mueller's legitimacy. Now, if you've been following us and me for a long time, probably since last August, you'll know that I am no stranger to the gray hat Mueller theory, white hat Mueller theory. I was definitely showing people why that might be the case for a very long time and backing up those theories with evidence that made me believe that way. And I've always said from the beginning, I may be wrong. And it looks like I might have been wrong, guys. Like, honestly, the more stuff comes out every day, the more I feel like I was just completely wrong, even though I stand by what I put out because it was sourced. Like, there were lightning bolts everywhere. And there are still questions that I don't have answers to that make me really, really, really scratch my head. But thoughts on that, Frank?
On Mueller?
Yeah.
I've never liked his face. Never liked his face.
Swiping left.
Him swiping left on him, swiping left on Cohen. Never liked them. And it's more and more obvious now that this is just what you said before, that he's running out the clock. It's November. It's try to push this to the finish line to help out. It's all hands on. First of all, you look at all of these CNN stories that have been debunked over the last 6 days or so that are still being run and they're not being updated or walked back at all. You look at all of the cards that are being left out on the table. Mueller's part of that. It is all building up an illusion. It's a multi-layered presentation of a reality that the left is trying to create and trying to keep relevant until the day for everybody to go out there and to vote and to give their one last shot of really putting a stake through the heart of all these investigations and what is certainly going to lead to their doom on many levels, not just electoral levels. We're talking about organizational levels. This should lead to extermination. You know, so I that's what the Mueller's just one piece in the whole puzzle right now that is playing a part to be able to get this to the finish line in November. After that, I don't know.
I know. And you know, the funny thing is like I was talking to somebody the other day and I was saying, like, it's really sad that we have to live in this world where we are basically as people being used as pawns in this big giant game of chess and in so many different ways, both from the good guys and the bad guys, because public opinion is key to all of this happening.
Yeah, and they're meddling with an election.
Well, yeah, basically. And they're also meddling with the future of the country at the same time. Like, the thing is like, the way things are being released, the way the media is choosing to release stories, the way the friendly media is choosing to release stories. When I say friendly, I mean to the truth. The time that they're coming out, the way things are being leaked out, like, we can't get the whole story. And then there's disinformation out there on purpose to make people think a certain way. And nobody knows which end is up. And it's really, really just one big psychological operation on the American people from both sides. That's my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I think that ultimately the left is always has a leg up on things because of, I don't know. First of all, they walk in unison, and the other side, and whatever. And when I say the other side, I mean just anybody who does not identify with the roving mob that is the left. I mean, there's so many different shades on the anti-progressive side that people just want to be independent and be left alone, no matter what their personal, professional, religious, whatever their interests are. It doesn't matter. I think that where we're at a disadvantage, especially by not having really any kind of controlling interest or any kind of any kind of level playing field as far as our cultural institutions go, because they are the ones that are actually able to set narratives and rethink history. We're just talking about Ryan Gosling a little bit and this first man moon landing film. I mean, they're able to reinterpret and reimagine history and create the platform on which we have our most basic conversations. So where I think that we really come at a loss sometimes is that not only does the left, even if the left is wrong, people who would, I guess, be considered right wing still have their debates on the premise that the left has set. So we are always debating within their arena. Even if we're winning the argument, we're always on the defensive because they set all of the premises that we of every conversation we have. So I think that's where we really come at a loss, because, and that is mainly because we have no real competing interest in the cultural institutions that we have here, including the media.
Yeah, and we can't. That was awesome. That was an awesome breakdown. And we can't right now anyway win them back. Like, we can't take over. We can't take them over. And I think that there's a lot of like I want to say a word and I can't. Consternation. How do you say it?
Consternation.
Consternation. Yeah.
Consternation.
Whatever. I think there's a lot of that going on within the right or the non-progressive left, like even in the middle, right? Because we're free thinkers. And so because we're free thinkers and we're not herded into group mentality, we disagree with one another.
Yeah.
And it makes it harder for us to band together around one solid concept because everybody has their own brain that does their own thinking. And we don't agree on everything, which is great. But it also is a hindrance when you have a herd who agrees on everything or is scared into or frightened into agreeing on everything.
Well, there's another example of it. Like, let's say there is a thread or an independent investigation or a theory that is being proposed and is being examined on the right. If it starts catching wind, if it starts catching any kind of momentum, what you'll see is you'll eventually see some people poking at it from the left. At that point, once it becomes mainstream, because they control what is accessed in the mainstream, like we just said before, once something that they poke at, it becomes mainstream, then different elements of the right jump in there to show just they want it's I mean, listen, Ben Shapiro is guilty of this more than anybody else, of needing to show just how independent he is by going in and giving credence to whatever the hell the left is doing to poke at certain things on the right. So there you go. We are so willing to criticize ourselves. It comes to a fault where we don't stop and think about how it could be used and is constantly being used against us to splinter us, because that's the whole thing. There really is a lack of group mentality there. People are always disagreeing and splintering off. It's, you know, talk about sectarianism. Crazy.
Yeah, it is. And you know, we can use that as an advantage if we would just come to the table together and sit down and figure it out. There are so many more of us.
Yeah.
There really are. Anyway, political theory on the Frank and Beans podcast.
I like it.
It was good. So Mueller, the Mueller investigation and the theorizing and all of that. Again, free thinking. President Donald Trump's legal team is crafting a counter report that will seek to delegitimize the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian election meddling and present countervailing arguments. Rudy Giuliani told the Daily Beast that part of his report would examine whether the initiation of the investigation was even legitimate or not. The bulk of the report will be divided into two sections. One will seek to question the legitimacy of the Mueller probe generally by alleging possible conflicts of interest by federal law enforcement authorities. That's huge. I mean, how many of them are there between Finkelstein and
Weissman
and, you know, Mueller and everybody. I mean, everybody. They've all got conflicts of interest donating to the Democratic Party. You know, I mean, the whole thing is a one big conflict of interest, which is why it led me to believe that there was something else going on, because how could they be so blatant about it? I mean, really?
Very blatant.
It was out there. It was right there in your face.
You just mentioned two things right there about donations to the Democratic Party and whatnot, and I brought up the Weissman name, and you think about just that one little circle right there where you have Weissman and this Bruce Ohr testimony, and we're talking about the dossier.
Yep.
He did not he had you know, knowledge of Weissman did, who's on this Mueller probe, and did not pretty much put that out there. Didn't really make it known that he had He had knowledge of it in the past. And this is already a group of people who have donated to the party, and the party itself and its main candidate and the incumbent president's organization were donating pretty much millions of dollars. I mean, it was like, what was it, a $12 million price tag for the dossier at Fusion GPS?
Yeah, if not more, if not more. But, and also, in addition, there were Clinton Foundation attorneys. I mean, you know, former Obama administration people. Like, it's crazy. And, you know, with the Orr Weissman stuff, this is one of those times where we can stop and speculate for a few minutes. Like, sincerely speculation. I hope everybody's hearing this loud and freaking clear, okay? I read this yesterday, that coming out from Herridge from Fox, that Orr testified that he was briefing Andrew Weissman, lead attorney on the Mueller probe, about the dossier during the time, because they worked together, you know, in the Department of Justice. This is the thing for me. Orr is also testifying as, and we don't have his testimony, guys, okay? We have what people are leaking from the testimony. And you did a really good job on your show the other night of some, like, it appeared as though somebody was anonymously inside those hearings, anonymously posting on the chans about what was going on in the hearing as it was happening. And we were able to kind of validate some of those points. And it could have been somebody in there for all we know. I mean, nobody has released a transcript. We've had a bunch of like little birdies chattering around, but we don't have anything solid, right?
Right. We have tweets. We have tweets from congressional members that give a lot of credence. We have a lot of credence to what was being leaked out. We have also just, you know, timelines match up when the hearings were actually going on from the morning and stretching several hours with many recesses and all that. You know, there's some things, some questions to be asked, but still at this point, like we said, when we're not in the know and we're not given anything, whatever we do have, we are allowed to speculate at least a little bit, as long as you put it out there that we're all just talking like friends, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yes. And so we don't have we don't have anything solid. We have rumors and innuendo and sources, and even sometimes straight from the congressman's mouth or congresswoman's mouth, whatever. And so they come out with this thing. They say first that Bruce Orr has been testifying that he said, and he warned everyone, that the dossier was bull, that it wasn't legitimate, that there were things wrong with it, that it couldn't have been trusted. And he's also saying that he told Weissman about this throughout the time. So if that's the case, if he's talking to Weissman about the dossier, and he's also saying he knows throughout this time that the dossier is bull, then what is his wife doing, first of all? Like, isn't he telling his wife, dude, what are you doing on this, lady? I mean, what is this all about? He's trying to make himself out to be like the sacrificial lamb in the situation. And then, outside of the wife, what if you go back to the theory about gray white, what if he's telling Weissman, who's then, I highly doubt this because Weissman's a snake, but what if Weissman's saying to Mueller, here, look at this dossier information, I got this from Bruce Orr, we need to, you know, what if he's the third party relaying this stuff back to Mueller about the dossier not being legitimate? Like, we don't know what the hell Mueller's doing, who he's investigating, or we only see what we say. We don't know who he's talked to, who he's interviewed in front of the grand jury, what they've said. We don't know any of that stuff. What are your thoughts on the possibility that maybe Weissman knows the jig is up, or has known the jig is up for a long time? And, you know, I guess I'm being stupid. That can't be possible. It can't be possible that they're doing the right thing.
That they're doing who's doing the right thing?
That the special counsel is doing the right thing. It can't be possible.
They know what this is about. First, like I said before, they've already done enough to sell to people that the reasons for launching the probe were legitimate. Even if it comes down to all of this was bullshit, and you know, it came out that there was nothing there. Look at what we found along the way, though. Along the way, even, you know, we did this out of out of love for our country. The special counsel, we went there to make sure, and who would ever fault us for trying to make sure that our elections were being run with integrity? And you know what? Along the way, we found people who were dealing with foreign entities, and they were hiding tens of millions of dollars. And we found, dozens and dozens of faceless Russians who were meddling with our election on Twitter with hashtags and menial amounts of money on Facebook. I mean, they've already legitimized themselves. They have all the fallback narratives they can go to say that, you know what, we had at least we did what we thought was our patriotic duty. Yeah, we didn't find anything. And all this new information that's coming out is really damning. But while we were here and while we were working, look at what we found. So there are fallback places. There are you got to remember one thing. These people will never admit defeat.
Yeah.
Ever. So to think that we're going to have some kind of satisfaction of that coming, get that out of your head. There are fallback narratives for everything. And there's already enough names and bodies that have been stacked like cordwood to legitimize what they've been doing. The other thing, too, is we're talking about all the speculation that we're left to be doing from these closed door hearings and maybe giving some kind of validation based on the tweets that we see coming out of some congressmen and women that were in the session and all that stuff, and piecing things together because we don't really know too much. But when you brought up Weissman, and you brought up, you know, the question of the legitimacy of the dossier and all that stuff. You remember, I mean, we can pull from other places to legitimize some types of thoughts. And that being, it was in you know, the first quarter of 2017, James Comey was still saying that the dossier was largely unverified and salacious and all that stuff. At that point, there had already been a couple of renewals of the FISA warrant and two rejections based on that shit. So, I mean, there is you don't even have to talk about what some people were tweeting about around the time of the Bruce Orr hearing to know. I mean, just think about that. And then, of course, Andrew McCabe's testimony about the importance of the dossier in the FISA warrant process. It's some serious shit.
It's really horrible. Like, I want to believe that there's some good in people. I think because I'm an eternal optimist, I'm always kind of, I don't want to believe that we could have such a corrupt, horrible institution in our country that this is possible. It's really, really sad.
It's not about believing in a corrupt institution. It's about believing in if you expand and expand and expand these institutions.
Yep.
And of course, all these institutions are just people. It's just there's collections of people. And what can you say about what kind of faith we can have in the ability of humans to not be corrupted when you give somebody a little bit too much power in an administrative role at a local YMCA, they start doing things that them and their friends.
Go in an internet chat room, go in like a Telegram room and give somebody mod power and see how long it takes before they turn into a dictator.
That's it. Seriously, you want to figure out what politics is all about. You want to figure out what's going wrong in government. Take a look at how every internet chat room is moderated on the internet. And you'll know exactly what happens when you give people even a scintilla of power and influence.
Yeah, they could have just like editing power and it's over. Oh, so funny. Listen, this is the thing, though. Let me eat crow on the special counsel for now, okay? I will eat crow on it, and I've always said that I have no problem doing it, admitting when I'm wrong. I came to the conclusions I came to based on what was available, and again, still have many questions on it, but it's just at the point right now where I'm like, holy moly, this is just horrible. I mean, it's getting bad. So they're coming out with this, nobody's going to like that I'm saying this. I mean, I feel it's hard, but whatever. It is what it is. I can't be... You know, you gotta fluctuate. You gotta learn when new information comes out and new things happen. You have to be able to shift, right? And I think it all comes back down to, too, the fact that we're not told anything and we're left to kind of figure this stuff out on our own because nobody tells us the truth. So, hey, it happens. Maybe I'll be proven right in the end. Who knows? But I hope that happens. I doubt it, but I hope it does. They're writing their own little back and forth, though. So the first section is going to be possible conflicts of interest. And the second section will focus on on the meat of Mueller's investigation. He doesn't know exactly what his findings will look like. Giuliani doesn't. So making the act of that makes the act of putting this big counter report together challenging. So since they have to guess what it is, it's a very, very, very long report. They're going to spend a lot of this weekend kind of paring it down. And then if it goes, the first half is 58 pages of conflict of interest. I can't wait to dig into this thing. The second half, if it goes over 100 pages, they're saying it needs to be broken into an executive summary. And he said he's getting most of the information that he's including in the second half open source, which means I can guarantee that we'll see in this thing a lot of the work that some of the brilliant researchers on Twitter and elsewhere have done over the past 18 months or so inside of this. I can nearly guarantee it. Like I would be surprised if like a story or two that we've spoken about and broken down together isn't in there.
It's gonna be interesting. I'll be in the stands watching like the rest of us.
Yeah. Good stuff. And then we've got Bruce Orr, Nelly Orr, Glenn Simpson, a tweet by somebody I've been following a lot lately. His name is Dawson S. Field. He just popped up out of nowhere, and the dude has some really good stuff. I don't agree with everything, but a lot of his stuff is really good. So he posted, he seems to recall Glenn Simpson of Fusion GPS testifying under oath to Congress that he did not employ any Russian speakers other than Ed Baumgartner on his team. I guess he forgot about his Russian speaker who's working on the Trump dossier.
Hmm.
Nelly Orr speaks Russian, and Donald Trump made a point to say she's fluent in Russian. And in the transcript of Glenn Simpson's testimony, he makes it a point to say nobody that spoke Russian except this person was on this, trying to basically he perjured himself. I mean, a gazillion times inside of his testimony now, which leads me back to why in the hell did Dianne Feinstein sneeze out this transcript back in the day?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, there could be something more. There could be something very specific, or it could just be they're playing the best hand that they can whenever they can. And it's not like any of the choices that they have in front of us are good choices, but they got to do something. Maybe at the, remember, you're talking about that Dianne Feinstein leak with the Glenn Simpson hearing. That was many months ago now.
Yes.
So it's like so long ago. So you think when you're playing, if you try to put yourself in their position, you're hedging your bets that, all right, well, if this gets out there and people who are going to be brought in to testify, they see the notes from class and they're able to study the notes. So when they come in for their quiz, they remember what answers to go by and what to avoid and what to be fuzzy on the details and what this and that. You know, it seems like something that you think you can get by with and get it on out there. And hopefully within the time that it takes to get down, first of all, to once again get to November.
Did you disappear? Frank disappeared. Oh, no. Oh,
uh-oh.
You're back.
I'm back?
Yes.
What was cut off?
In the time it takes to get to November.
And maybe in the time it takes to get to November, this would all reach a conclusion that is favorable, something that they can control. I don't think that anybody, whether it be Schiff or whether it be Feinstein or anybody, has been making choices that they really think are really, safe bets. I think that they're just doing the best they can.
You got to think about it from this perspective, too. The Chinese spy story and who worked for Feinstein. Mm. Who worked for her? You know, we had, what's his name, Jones, who was tied into that committee, the Select Committee on Intelligence, the Senate Select Committee. And that Chinese spy working with her for 20 years, if you put pieces together and you start to kind of look at it from a broad 20,000-foot view, the Clinton server being hacked by the Chinese is starting to kind of play a little bit of a different role now. Now we've got two members that are very, very high up in the intelligence apparatus being spied on by the Chinese. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So, how does the Glenn Simpson testimony leaking from her play into that? I mean, I don't even know how that didn't come back to bite her harder. But outside of and then we also have with her, the Democratic Party basically banishing her and not endorsing her for this next election. They've distanced themselves from her. So what position is she playing? What role is she playing right now? Who's going after her? You know, is that story that leaked in the media about her and the Chinese spy for 20 years coming from a position of the powers that be, the establishment attacking her in the media to try and diminish her power because maybe she's flipped? Or is it coming from the perspective of the white hats in the sphere releasing that story in dribs and drabs to diminish her power because she's pulling shenanigans? Which, putting all those pieces together is what I like. That's how I spend my time, just kind of trying to look for open source bits of information that would give us a better idea throughout a timeline of what's going on and then coming to some sort of a conclusion that feels the best. So what's going on with her? And that totally plays into the Glenn Simpson thing we're just talking about, because Glenn Simpson is in a world of trouble and he's now perjured himself on top of everything else, albeit in a small way, but still there's many more examples. So was Diane in the know about how these things were going to be rolled out and getting in front of herself by releasing this? Who knows? Am I making sense, Frank?
Yeah, you are.
Okay. That's my thought process. That's Tracy Beans' mind right now. Raw.
All I know is that we have about 9 weeks until the election.
Oh, gosh, I'm so excited about that. You know, I did a scope yesterday, which is really rare for me. I never do those. And I was
basically
a Periscope.
Oh.
Yeah. And I did one. And I was like, because I wanted to tell people to watch my video about the whole or didn't go in front of Huber thing. Because it was, I couldn't thread it out. I had to do it in a video. So I wanted people to watch it. So I wanted to go on a scope and tell people to watch it. And I ended up just doing a rant. Like, there's this whole big group of people that are basically saying that people are apathetic because they think that things are, justice is going to be served. So there's a section of the population on the Republican side that is apathetic to the midterms because they think that some big grand plan is being rolled out and they don't have to take responsibility to vote. And I countered with, I think that that's absolute. I don't think anybody thinks that they don't have to vote in November.
I don't know how on earth that I don't know how on earth anybody could have taken part in 2016's election and think that 2018 is any less vital.
Yeah.
No way.
You know, just because you might subscribe to the optimistic plan that, you know, all of this is going to go down, everybody's going to get arrested and put in jail, like that should drive you to vote even more. Yep. Because if the Democrats win, there's no chance in hell that's ever going to happen. So I don't understand that argument. It's like splitting people into little factions of like bickering little monkey. No, I can't say monkeys. Monkeys is a bad word again.
Oh, yeah. No, you can't say it to anybody.
My bad.
Oh, well, I call Chris Cuomo a monkey all the time.
Shame on you, you racist pig.
Yeah, well, he's a monkey and he wears a monkey suit. He's a big meathead bastard.
Swear.
Oh, racist. My God. What is going on in New York? Did you see our two Democratic governor hopefuls talking to each other at that Fordham debate?
I didn't watch the debate, thank God, because I heard nothing but it was a catastrophe, like a walking catastrophe. I have three people, Frank, that came to me that still live up there my that are asking me to get them listings because they're moving legitimately.
Yeah, no, it's bad. It's bad. And you listen to these two nutcases, both Governor Gavone and the other one over here. What is her name? Miranda Hobbs. You have two of these people sitting there slinging shit at each other. They're part of the same party, but one wants to go even more extreme. And they're arguing with each other over the only thing that Cuomo kept on reverting back to is how Trump is bad for New York and you got to fight Trump. And then you have Cynthia Nixon, who says she's qualified to be governor because she's been a lifelong LGBT activist. Mm. Okay. I mean, I don't know what even the hell that means. And then of course, everything else comes down to, we have a state budget of $170 billion already, and she just wants to spend more. They want to spend even more. You want to talk about the exodus from New York to the Carolinas? It's going to get worse.
I'm going to share my story quickly because I've never done it before, and it's a perfect opportunity. I lived on Long Island. I owned a home. Me and my husband were over the moon when we were able to buy our first home together. It was something that we never thought attainable in New York, ever. And we were able to buy a home on Long Island. And we lived there for, I don't know, about a year or so. And the taxes just kept going up and going up. I don't remember exactly what they were when we decided to leave, but it was like somewhere in the $12,000 to $13,000 a year range.
That's actually cheap compared to where we are right now.
Now, yes. Yeah. So this was a couple of years ago. So I was, we refinanced, which was the biggest mistake ever. And I guess when they did the refinance the first time, they made an error in the escrow or something like that. I don't know. They made an error and we had an escrow shortage. So our mortgage payment ended up going up to be like, I swear, I kid you not, it was almost $3,700 a month just to pay my mortgage.
Jeez.
Okay. I was working two jobs. My husband was working two jobs. We have two small children. We could barely eat dinner, like legitimately, between daycare expenses, which were almost $2,000 a month, and the mortgage, which was $3,700. We're over $5,000 a month just without utilities, without car insurance, without health insurance, without anything. And nothing available to help because you got to eat. Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, to be honest with you, there was no quality of life whatsoever because I was working literally 18 hours a day, every day. I ended up in the hospital, to be quite honest with you, because I was working so much, I could barely take care of myself. And my kids didn't get to spend any time with their parents because my husband worked the night shift and I worked the day shift. It was horrible quality of life. And not only that, but they kept on making these policy changes that were just completely pushing. They were strangling us. We were suffocating, and we couldn't get out of the house because it was underwater. It was underwater. We wouldn't be able to pay the mortgage off. So we ended up having to short sell. We had to short sell the house. It was just the only option. We could not stay. It was just not an option for us to stay there, and we had to leave. And I had to short sell my. It was as much of a not that I want to share my personal business with everybody, but as much of a horrible sort of a failure it was for us as a young couple together trying to survive. You know, it was
this is the horrible situation. It's not just you. I mean, I just even think about. And even young couples, that's one thing for a young couple to think that, hey, well, you know, this is our home and we grew up here and now we're going to be able to forge our own life here where we grew up and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, all those good things. But what about all the old couples? You know, I'm thinking about all of the I know that a lot of elderly and retiring folks around here like to consider leaving New York just because they don't want to deal with the winters anymore. But aside from that, I know plenty of people who just had to leave, and they had to leave behind, you know, dozens of children and grandchildren combined. And, you know, it's a big, big thing because the other thing you have to plan for, it's another thing when you are young and you have the ability, you know, you and your husband, even though you were facing something, a situation that was pretty dire, you're still young. You still have your whole lives ahead of you, and you have the flexibility and you're able to go out and earn more and to adapt to a new situation. When you get older and older over here and you see the state is getting worse and worse and you're on a fixed income, you know, that is whether it be Social Security and a pension, whatever you got. And there is no flexibility. That's even worse.
No. It's true. And, you know, not to get on a big rant about New York, but like, listen, I grew up in New York. I lived my entire life there. It's my home state. I never went anywhere else. I lived in New York. I lived in Brooklyn. I lived in Queens. I lived upstate. I lived on Long Island. Like, New York was like everything, right? To see what they have done there, the liberal policies of that state, how they have completely choked and destroyed the middle class. They want the middle class to leave. It's either you're a welfare state, you know, you're the welfare class, or you are the elite rich there. There is no in between anymore, really, especially not on Long Island. And it's by design. It's by design. They want the middle class to be choked out there. They want them to be. And so, you know, trying to fight on Long Island against those policies, and I think I've mentioned a couple times, like Rep. Lee Zeldin was somebody that we worked really hard to get elected on Long Island. Like, you know, I was really involved in all of that stuff. And just to see, you know, listen, not woe is me. We did what we had to do. We were going to lose our house if we didn't. We were going to lose our house, and it was an unbearably horrible, terrifying, it was horrible. It was a horrible situation to be in. But so many Americans are in this situation, especially in these liberal states where you've got these two, like you said, socialist crazy people wanting to run the state. I just went off on a rant, and I'm sorry.
And that's just New York at the same time. And I'm glad I had a couple of good friends watching last night. And, you know, I have good, we have a decent showing of Cuban Americans whose, you know, family ties are from Cuba, who watch the show. And, you know, we're talking about New York. We were talking about Florida. I have a friend of mine, George, whose family had to escape Cuba after having all of their land taken after the revolution, came to Florida. Some of them made their way back up to New York. But still, down there in Florida, you have an avowed socialist who's touring with Bernie Sanders out there, talking about bringing ideas that will slow walk them back to the same kind of place that many of the people who are in Miami that came there, that arrived there on floating barges of garbage just to get away from this kind of mentality. This is what they might. This is what the party offered up as a solution for the governorship. Oh, man. And of course, the only thing that they have to go after Ron DeSantis was this. First of all, I don't know why he couldn't have heard it coming out of his mouth and knowing how it's going to be used.
That's nonsense.
It is nonsense.
I'm sorry. Self-censoring like that just because you're afraid. We can't.
It is nonsense. And that's why seriously, this is the first time I've even talked about it. This has been tried to be made news since like Tuesday. Okay. And I have not even brought it up because it is not worth anybody's time. The whole monkeying up thing. Oh God, not worth anybody's time.
If this is all they have on him, then Florida's in good shape.
I hope so. I hope so. Because who the hell wants that?
So there's our midterms conversation for the day.
Yeah.
Really? I mean, it's so important, you guys. I don't think anybody out there thinks like, oh, no, we don't have to vote. This will be all, everything will be great. No worries. Trump's going to take care of everything. He'll do it all by himself. Don't even worry about it.
Well, the reason why it gets a little bit money for people is, and that's why I've been saying it for weeks now, take the time out from now, do a little bit of inquiry into who is running in your district, who is running for your governorship. It's a lot different than going, every 4 years and saying, okay, well, this is the person I want for president, as if that should really even matter in this republic. It actually shouldn't. We need to be able to scale back the imperial presidency that's been created and make it matter even less. But what confuses people is most people have never spent time considering who their local representatives are, what's going on in their state, in their state houses.
Yep.
Nobody thinks about that. You have to. And this is a big reason why.
Yeah, there needs to be, like I was talking to somebody about what to do. And I said, there needs to be, first of all, there's a party problem because the good old boys in the party don't want these new people involved in their politics. They are very, exclusionary. The local Republican like clubs don't want these new people, these Trump populist, Make America Great Again people coming in to try and take over their control of local politics. And they'll do anything and everything in their power to make it as difficult as possible for people to gain a foothold inside the machine. I went through this with Ron Paul, so I know very well.
Well, here, this is the funnier thing. You can say that, with Ron Paul, there is a real example of someone who can get scorn from their party for being anti-establishment. And in a way that is verifiable on a number of levels. Ron Paul is a true federalist, a libertarian leaning federalist,
yep,
who believes in the Constitution and true separation of powers down to localization of government to the highest degree that you can possibly get.
Yeah.
Actual anti-establishment outside of being anti-establishment of your own party. There's an establishment wing of your party, but then there's also that in itself is within a larger establishment. Now you have people like Andrew Gillum in Florida or Miranda Hobbs over here, Cynthia Nixon in New York, who tout themselves as anti-establishment, anti-democratic establishment. But what establishment do they really stand by? They stand by the most historically centralized, large, overbearing, authoritarian establishment that could possibly be created. And that is a socialist government.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you? So on one hand, you have people like Ron Paul who are anti-party establishment and also anti-establishment as far as the overwhelming state. And then you have people like Cynthia Nixon and Andrew Gillum who say, well, you know what? The Democrat Party are afraid of us. But aside from that, they want to make the federal government even more of a Leviathan.
No, it's a multifaceted, kind of discussion that we're having here too, because what you said is completely true and 100% valid. And if you take the pieces in the battlefield and you kind of like lay the pieces out, when Ron Paul was running 2012, let's just take, right, we ran a delegate strategy, and we were very, we learned parliamentary procedure. We worked our asses off to learn how government actually worked, how the local races worked, how the party structure was, what the rules were, how we could use those rules to kind of get around certain things. We busted our butts learning, and we were able to successfully infiltrate a lot of different places, like Las Vegas, for example. Las Vegas was one place where the Ron Paul wing of the Republican Party took over the committee. And the thing is that if people are going to start getting involved in their local races and their local government and even state government in terms of, you know, U.S. representatives and stuff like that, they're going to need to infiltrate and become a part of this establishment structure inside of their states. And they're going to need energy and passion to do it. But that's really the only way it's going to change. And to be quite honest with you, a lot of people have no idea how to do that. They don't know how to. It's a game. It's a dirty game. It sucks. But the only way that we're going to take it back is by doing that.
Why do you think they don't teach civics in school anymore?
There you go. Just the honest truth, guys. Like, seriously, living through it for 8 years. I know. Trust me. Not that I'm like, I don't think I could teach a class on how to do it, but it needs to be done. So I think that's the bigger problem is, like, you talk about getting people involved in local politics. Well, the obstacles there for most people who, you know, they're just everyday Americans going to work every day, busting their butts, putting food on the table, taking care of their kids, bringing them to soccer. And then you're going to ask them to spend, or they need to. They should be ready to spend hours and hours and hours and hours every week trying to bust the establishment hierarchy out of these local institutions that run things. And it's effort and time, and you're going to cry. You're going to cry.
Yep.
I'm sorry. I went off on such a tangent.
No, it's good. We needed it.
We got 10 minutes left, but 12 minutes left. Let's go to Papadopoulos. So we had Papadopoulos saying he's going to take the plea. Then we had Papadopoulos saying he's not going to take the plea. Then now we have Papadopoulos saying he's going to take the plea again. And this is going to tie into John Solomon's report that he just came out with, which I'm going to read to you verbatim because it irks me. This is another speculative thing, okay? It rubs me the wrong way, John Solomon's new piece. It's about Joseph Mifsud. Have you read it?
I have not, but I want to know more. And before you do so, do you have any, is there anything known about what this potential plea is about?
Oh, he's going to plead guilty to lying to investigators.
Oh.
You know, the original charges.
Okay.
Yeah. The original charges, they got him because he lied about dates and, you know, whatever. There's been an argument back and forth. Like, what was his role? Did he know? Some people think he was unwitting and he got the wool pulled over his eyes. Other people, like myself, think he knows a lot more than he's letting on. And his wife is just a complete wild card in this whole thing. Like the flip flopping back and forth and back and forth. Whew. She's been a problem for him. And she knew Mifsud for years and years. Pretended she didn't, then said she did. Very, very interesting. So I want to read this column from Solomon. It's long, but I need to read it because I'm not going to say anything. I just want your initial input, Frank. Okay.
Okay.
Are you good to go a few minutes long if we have to?
Yeah, I have to go. I'm working out at 12:30, so we have a half hour still.
Perfect. Okay. If one reads Special Counsel Robert Mueller's court filings against George Papadopoulos, it's hard not to conclude that the former Trump campaign aide lied to FBI agents to hide some sinister plot with Russia. Now, let me be clear. I don't condone lying to anyone, especially the FBI. But there's a much different version of events than the one spun by prosecutors and court filings, Democrats in Congress, or more reporters, an account kept from the public for more than 18 months. It comes from one of the FBI's primary sources in the Papadopoulos case, European professor Joseph Mifsud. Documents I obtained from sources show Mifsud told the FBI in 2017 in February that his contacts with Papadopoulos a year earlier during the 2016 presidential campaign were mostly innocuous. He made that point both in an FBI interview and a follow-up email to agents. He described the contacts as an academic exercise in the pursuit of peace, not a global plot to hijack the election. And he went out of his way to say there was no talk of sinister cybersecurity intentions such as a plot to hack Hillary Clinton's emails. Quote, I reaffirm that the content of our conversations was always on the wide geostrategic issues, end quote. He wrote to FBI agents on February 11th in an email that was quickly sent to the very top of the FBI's counterintelligence division. Mifsud sent the email just hours after agents interviewed him. He said the conversations mostly centered around how the Trump then campaign team looked to develop a conversation on Europe and the UK and with Russia and the fallout in policy and the deteriorating relationship between the major countries in the world today. Geez, sounds more like a topic for a Miss Universe contestant's essay on world peace than the opener of a James Bond movie. Mifsud acknowledged he introduced Papadopoulos to a contact in Russia, whom he identified as Dr. Timofey, who he described as a, quote, director of a think tank in Moscow with strong links to a number of U.S. institutions. But again, he stressed the contacts were mostly academic in nature. Dr. Timofeev and I have been collaborating for a number of years on a number of geostrategic issues, mainly pertaining to publications, training for diplomats, international experts on energy security, and their implications on international relations, Mifsud told the FBI. After speaking to both individuals, I put them in contact with each other. The intent of that bridging was specifically of a geopolitical nature and not tied in any way to form to cybersecurity, Mifsud insisted to the FBI. It was to create a mutual understanding on world affairs and how we can contribute to peace and stability. The mere fact that Mifsud felt compelled after his interview to write a follow-up email, repeatedly insisting his contacts with Papadopoulos were innocuous, is an indication he didn't like the way the FBI portrayed events. In fact, at one point in his email, he bold-faced a single sentence for emphasis. Cybersecurity was never the direct object of any of our communications. Now, I'm going to stop there. The next paragraph I'm going to read really quickly is one, and then I'm going to stop and ask your opinion. Let's take those allegations in order. Lying to the FBI, yes, is a crime. But having a foreigner tell you a foreign country may have dirt on a candidate is not a crime. And neither is trying to arrange for a presidential candidate to visit a foreign country. And all the aides who held backdoor conversations with foreign leaders to arrange for Obama's pre-2008 election trip to Afghanistan, the Middle East, and Europe would have to go to jail too. That makes no sense. I'm just stopping there. What do you think so far?
I was trying to listen to you and weigh out why you were upset with it, or why you thought this was one of his more dubious articles.
Yeah.
Because I mean the Mifsud thing was always harmless. In my perspective, the Mifsud interactions were always harmless. It's just that they were being used in a harmful way, and of course his backgrounds with British intelligence and his background and his ties to Russia, that was always a little bit more of where I figured it might be just a subtle thing. Subtle little ties that can tell you why these harmless things were done. Like, for example, the Veselnitskaya meeting, harmless meeting. The booking of the meeting itself, harmless. But in the end, when you look at it, the real use of the entire meeting was that it happened. And the fact that she was in Trump Tower is enough to make people that you and I are related to and you and I are friends with talk about for years as bona fide evidence that the president was trying to collude with a foreign power, even though they know nothing about the meeting and how it happened or whatever. And not only that, but as far as Mifsud goes, I've read articles in the past where it's even said that he made very specific that even though, you know, Russia might have information or unflattering information on Hillary Clinton or something like that, he never mentioned Trump's involvement in it. And or anything like that. So I don't know. Like I said, I look at a lot of this stuff as perfectly innocent things that were used in malicious ways to create a narrative for an event that never happened. So what's particularly rubbed you the wrong way about this?
Okay, so everything you said is 100% correct. Now, what I'm looking at here is we talked about this before. John Solomon has this whole story already. He's been dripping it out, right? We've talked about who his sources are. We've talked about the fact that Oleg Deripaska is talking to him. Adam Waldman is talking to him, right? This article comes out, and it's basically a... This is, again, my brain working. To me, the tone of this thing reads as a whitewash of Mifsud. Like, there is no possible way there were any nefarious intentions on the part of Joseph Mifsud. Look at what he said to the FBI. And he hasn't spoken to the FBI since February of 2017. And he hasn't been seen or heard from since. And Solomon has his emails to the FBI and his articles and things he said and testimony and questions and quotes. I just don't like how, geez, sounds more like a topic for a Miss Universe contestant's essay on world peace than the opener of a James Bond movie.
When I see Mifsud, I see him as one of those characters that could be, you know, we always talk about you grab the little fish, that there's really no real reason to go after them and try to make an example out of them, but you know that you might be able to go somewhere else with it. That's what I always, he's not a, unless there's something here that I'm missing and that I have completely overlooked, I've just always seen him as a convenient appearance. This guy made a very, very convenient appearance. Like, for example, nobody's going after Veselnitskaya because why would you? Why would you want to make an example out of her? Yes, she's working for Fusion GPS, who is not only working in this whole Prevazon Holdings case and anti-Magnitsky, but they're also working for the DNC and Hillary Clinton and creating the dossier. Veselnitskaya, who is a friend of who, I mean, I don't want to see her strung up, but she was just a very convenient piece that floated in and out, and just their mere presence was used by those who were really holding the strings. So as far as whitewashing goes, it doesn't bother me that much, because it doesn't take away what his importance in the entire overarching story was to me. And I don't know.
Because of Papadopoulos speaking to Mifsud and Mifsud supposedly telling Papadopoulos what he told him, he was set upon a chain of events that led him to Alexander Downer, who has direct ties to Stefan Halper. Now, could what you say be the case? 100%. It could be that it was a convenient thing, that Halper really was innocent and had nothing to do with any of this, and it just was a chance encounter. But I'm going to link in the show notes a great article that the Markets Work did on these connections, you know, several months ago. I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't know. If this is true, then great. I'm not saying that he's done bad reporting by any stretch. I mean, Solomon's done some fantastic work and he continues to. I'm looking at who it seems that is giving him his information for his stories. And I'm wondering what, if there's a puppeteer.
Okay. No, okay. I see what you're saying. I guess, yeah, when it comes back to Mifsud again, and I know that timeline, you know, between that him and Downer, it's always been the same thing for me with him, with this Mifsud guy, is just that he seemed like a bag man, where he handed off a bag, and the bag in this case is there are foreign powers that might have unflattering information on Hillary Clinton. Now the bag has been passed off to Papadopoulos, who can then go talk about that exchange over cocktails with Alexander Downer. You know, a necessary piece of the puzzle, Mifsud was, but you think about it, that's like going after, you know, Al Capone's numbers runner instead of Al Capone, you know?
Yeah, it's a complicated story. And you know, this makes up a big bulk of his charges and a big bulk of the FISA warrant. So it's a big story. It really is a big deal. If you know, if Mifsud is telling the FBI, this is all blown out of proportion, what are you even doing? And then in the charging documents that we read, I mean, in the recent sentencing recommendations that we read on Papadopoulos, they're saying Papadopoulos was responsible for them not being able to get Mifsud to talk to him more in depth about his involvement. But now we're learning from Solomon that Mifsud is basically stressing over and over again, even including emails after his testimony to the FBI, after his questioning sessions with the FBI, when they do question him, that this was nothing nefarious. You're out of your minds. That's not what Papadopoulos is really saying. if you look back at what Papadopoulos is saying, he's saying, yeah, he told me, you know, it's just amazing that he met with me. It was such a coincidence. It just, something doesn't jive. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'll have to look into it more in depth, but hey.
Well, this is the first of like the last four John Solomon articles that has rubbed you the wrong way though. Because he's had a pretty important 2018 up to this point.
Yeah. It's not that those other ones have rubbed me the wrong way at all.
I'm talking about this one rubbing you the wrong way.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, last one, my antenna were up for sure. The last two, actually, my antenna were starting to perk a little bit. Not that I'm like the end all be all, but I don't know. This one's a little, and the one before this was just a fluff piece, which I didn't understand. But hey, you know, just throwing it out there. Next week, maybe we'll have more to talk about. Oh, no, next week you're running the show on, you're doing the ship on your own.
Oh, you want to talk about this real quick so people don't freak out?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that.
Okay. You say it first.
Next week, I am going to be very, very busy on a super secret trip. And I won't be here. So Frank is going to run this show and do Dark to Light on his own for a week.
You hear that, everybody?
I think it's going to be great.
I think as long as everybody knows it's coming, we're going to see. We're going to see how the viewership does.
I'm sure that everybody will be fine, and I think we might even have you have a guest, right? Maybe.
That'd be great. That'd be great to split that up and talk to somebody for a half hour. That'd be really awesome. But we'll figure that out, and I'm up to the task. And I will do whatever necessary to help fill the gap. But you have important work going on. I can't wait until you can talk about all that stuff.
Yep.
And it'll be fun either way.
If it wasn't something of vital importance, I wouldn't be having this talk with you guys right now about the show. So we'll just say that.
The show must go on.
Well, thank you so much, guys, for listening to the Dark to Light podcast with
Frankie Val on the drums. That's my default.
Not F.
Not just the letter F.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. You guys can tune in and hear us on Google Play, Apple, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and RadioInfluence.com. And also, before we go, get over to the Apple iTunes review board and leave us a nice review and some stars over there. It really helps us out.
No, seriously. And I know that we've already been on for weeks and weeks and weeks now. But still, if you get on over to Apple, go to iTunes, you search Dark to Light, give it some stars, subscribe, leave a nice review. Even if you don't like what you hear talk about, be nice about it. Say, you know what, I don't agree with anything that Frank and Tracy say, but I think they put on a great show and it's worth listening to, even if you just want to make fun of them. You know, so you just got to do that. That little bit of – it takes like 45 seconds to click the stars and click the subscription and maybe write a nice little sentence or something like that. And, Tracy, I'll tell you, it makes such a difference in the visibility on the charts over there on iTunes. If we had like a concerted effort to get even a small portion of the people who listen to the show go on iTunes and show it some love, we would leapfrog over some pretty interesting people on the charts. I tell you that much, because even me, little old me, a couple of years ago when barely anybody was listening, I went through all my friends and family and I asked them over the course of a 2-week period that I put my podcast on iTunes. I said, listen, please give me a shot. Give me 45 seconds of your time going up there. I leapfrogged. I leaped right over Alex Jones and Rachel Maddow and Lena Dunham.
Oh my gosh, that's great.
Yeah, well, it lasted for as long as I had enough people I can keep going to. But we have a much larger base here, so I think that if people helped us out, I'm telling you, it would get noticed.
That would be great. I would love that. So audience members who listen to the show, thank you so much and help us out. And now that we've said all that, I think we can go.
Alrighty.
Have a great weekend, guys. We will talk to you soon.
Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day.
This is an Ian Beckles Flavor in Your Ear quick fix on Radio Influence.
We had the big race here in Florida. It's going to be DeSantis against Gillum. And we all heard it 1,000 times now. DeSantis came out and said, we don't want him to monkey this up. Okay. And then afterwards he said, well, he's a very articulate person. Does this make him racist? Nope, it does not. Does it make maybe the hair in the back of my neck stand up? Yep, probably. Is it a big deal that he's backed by Trump? Yeah, definitely. People say, well, just because he said he's articulate doesn't mean it's racist. And it doesn't mean it's racist. And as somebody who is African-American and somebody who I'm not going to say well-spoken because I've heard that my whole life. We could say I'm a wordsman. I'm able to use words. You know how many times in my life I've heard that I'm well-spoken? And somebody will say, well, that's not a big deal. That's not racist. And I'll say, has anybody said it to you? And they'll think, I mean, I'm a college graduate. I'm a college graduate. I'm a business person. I'm an entrepreneur. I have a radio show. I got my hands in some stuff. I don't want you to tell me I'm well-spoken. I don't tell Caucasian people they're well-spoken. They don't need to hear that. We don't need to hear it either. We don't. That's not a compliment. If you say I'm articulate, that means you think all other black people aren't. Think about that for a second. And when DeSantis came out and said we don't want him monkeying this up, I don't know what he meant.
You can find Ian Beckles' Flavor in Your Ear on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and RadioInfluence.com.